representative
right
of...
there with a pipe in his mouth.
The pipe in his mouth, you see.
Like
some people talk about me in these areas, too.
Thanks, Senator, I needed that.
He's an engineer and, who do you represent?
Associated General Contractor.
Associated General
Contractor. Oh, sure, no, I know him.
All right.
He's not dressed up.
Okay.
Nice.
Problem is, or the problem was indicated, that...
He's down in Chicago, I think, off on the page.
The agencies, the people dealing with agencies really didn't know what was going on. And... quite frankly, I'm inclined to agree with it. This present Administrative Procedure Act only requires that notices for agencies changing in their rules be published in the Secretary of State's bulletin, which, as Mr. Peterson pointed out, is about as informative as a legislative calendar, and probably less read, and that work has to be done in depth, and also the oral hearing problem. Well, addressing my consideration of the oral hearing problem and looking at the agencies, I tried to get across, and I think we have gotten across, that a lot of agency action nobody really cares about. And the requirement of setting a hearing date in which people can show up, you know, you have a party and nobody comes, that it, some action from the interested public should trigger off the necessity of saying, okay, at 3 o'clock in the Labor and Industries building in room 212, there will be an oral hearing, and persons may come, all right? You've got someone who sits there at 3 o'clock, and you may sit there till 5, and nobody shows up because nobody really cares. Another factor on oral hearings is, I think, it has been my experience, and I think the agency experience, that in the long run, the views, data, and opinions you get that someone had thought enough about to go down and put into writing and say, your rules should go this way, are the more valuable than sometimes the grandstand circuses that an oral hearing can be. Although the dialogue and exchange in an oral hearing can be good. For that reason, if you look at the proposed amendments to 171, starting in there.
The mock-up bill in your package.
Yeah. The mock-up bill.
Now, actually, what Mr. Lowy has done, he has drawn himself to the Attorney General for the use by the agencies a rule for agencies to be guided by in holding their hearings on these matters. What he's doing, in essence, is incorporating his formal work into the statute for the guidance of the agencies.
That's great. I move as adoption.
Who's proxy
is that? This is the bill he's talking about, all this stuff?
No. Back, near the back, there's a markup bill. Back of the summary.
Looks like this. Let me add, I had the committee's permission.
About five pages long.
I had the committee's permission to add to this bill certain housekeeping materials related between agency enabling acts and the administrative procedure.
When he says committee's permission, he's referring to Mr. Flynn.
Speaking on your behalf.
All right. So the mock-up bill is here. It says mock bill 31373. The proposed amendments to SB 71 are this package here, which runs to 27 pages.
Well, I thought the mock-up bill was it. What are you talking about?
All right, mock-up bill is changes to the act.
And then you're adding the other and
then I'm adding the housekeeping stuff on at the end.
Now, what are we housekeeping?
All right, we're housekeeping welfare, we're housekeeping the mandates on judicial review, we're housekeeping portions of the review procedures for the insurance commissioner, fair dismissals appeal board, state engineer, children's services, racing commission, and the board of pharmacy. And what these housekeepings...
Quite a bit of housekeeping.
It is, Senator, but as I indicate, to keep some trouble, I can provide you with letters from each of the agencies indicating they approve of this. These are primarily conflicts when an agency is brought under the Administrative Procedure Act. Something left over from the early days of its Enabling Act creates an apparent conflict. To give you a very good example of what we've got right now on that and this running up, the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board, which is the school district, I think you're familiar with it. There's a separate board to see if the school district fairly fired a particular teacher. Hanging over from the creation of the board and bringing the board within the APA was a provision that says nothing herein shall bar anyone from filing a petition for writ of review under the writ of review statute. All right, it says judicial review of the actions of the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board goes direct to the Court of Appeals. There are now pending, right now, one action on the same subject that started in the circuit court and is going up this way, plus at the same time, the same question being reviewed by the Court of Appeals, and that's just a waste of time. That's one of the cleanup. There are, the state engineer has a funny little procedure that when the act was originally enacted, they weren't in the APA, so they didn't have a clean procedure, so they worked up their own. That's what I talk about housekeeping, to bring the particular agency's Enabling Act and its review or conduct procedures into the APA so we don't waste time and money going two routes to have the same question answered. But that's jumping a little ahead. That's why I've got the section by section.
Well, now we're going to run into a serious question on the face of the bill of whether this is germane or not. What you've really done is you've created a new bill, and I think it may be a very good bill, but I'm very much afraid we can't get it through under this final. I don't know what the other members
think. Well, Madam Chairman, this is administrative procedures, and that's what line 2 says. What is the deficiency here?
Well, he's put in and require them to go to the Court of Appeals instead of the...
Does it all have to do with the Administrative Procedures Act?
Only to go to the... Not requiring them to go to the Court of Appeals, Senator, but only to that the Administrative Procedure Act's provision for judicial review, which is what creates the going to the Court of Appeals, is applicable. And no, I have required none to go to the Court of Appeals, but I have deleted, in some cases, is alternative circuit court procedures, because all of these agencies' contested case procedure are subject to the Administrative Procedure Act, and it merely says that in some cases they won't use the other procedures, alternative procedures, because if they're subject to contested case procedure, then it follows they go Court of Appeals, which they are now. It just deletes from them parallel review procedures, would be my suggestion. I think that the title, the line 2 line, there's nothing here that does not relate to. There's another small problem which was not thought of 2 years ago. What does the Court of Appeals do with its mandate when it finishes? When it makes its decision about an administrative agency, it's silent as to that. Now, we're all familiar, because this is new. Never before did you go from an agency. You always had a circuit court intervening, and the Court of Appeals sent its mandate down to the circuit court, which moved on from there. The Court of Appeals has said to us, well, what do we do? We know what we do. We send it back to the agency. But say it's a money judgment. This, one of the sections in here allows the prevailing party to request that the mandate of the Court of Appeals be directed to a particular circuit court so that you can get a cost judgment or a money judgment through circuit court. Agencies, unless there's a statutory provision, have no immediate procedure for executing upon a final judgment. They have to go to the circuit court. That's this again. It's a 183-480 area. I have tried as much as possible, and I believe that I could substantially, any, you know, not relating title to not reveal subject of bill challenge, I could defend every one of these proposed sections, because I was aware of that. It would have to add amending certain other statutes that I would recognize, but I think the amendment could just add the additional statutory references to the amendment.
Al, do you see any necessity on amendment to subparagraph B? Opportunity for oral hearing must be granted if requested by five persons. Do you see any necessity for putting in some provision, oral hearing upon timely request?
Wait a minute. I thought I took care. No, I took care of that in another area. I took care of that in reconsideration. Yes, I'd agree with you, and I would.
Let's add that then.
Maybe we could set a specific date too. Now that could go into the. Of course, I think you could make upon timely request a matter of reasonable judgment.
Yeah.
All right, then on the proposed amendments. On the first page of it, we could put the fourth paragraph down on line 15 after writing a certain opportunity must be granted if upon timely request. Delete requested and insert upon timely request by five persons.
Where are you?
On the proposed amendments package.
Yeah.
Fourth. Full paragraph beginning on line 15 after writing,
yeah.
Insert, and then quote, opportunity for oral hearing must be granted, delete if requested, and substitute upon timely request,
okay.
By five persons. And I think we can give agency advice as what is timely without setting a specific.
That would come under the Administrative Procedures Act.
All right. That that is the Senator Halleck request. The if the public wants an oral hearing, they should get it. You believe this is valid? I can see no requirement, with the point that there are some, not making it absolute in everyone, because there are some that nobody cares. Now the second one. On subparagraphs, on paragraphs 4 and 5 on page 1 and 2. Oh. And then I have an insert after line 16. This is Mr. Kalinowski's request, which we add a subsection C, which you can see in the mock-up bill at the bottom of the first page. When an agency is going to amend, adopt a rule, sometimes it says, gives a date of its intended action. That is, we will get our hearing, take our data, and then we will adopt a rule effective X date. Mr. Kalinowski pointed out, and I think very justifiably, the date may be specifically stated, or the date may be in the date of publication in the Secretary of State's bulletin, whichever is sooner. He says, okay, it comes out, there it is, and what do we do with it? That's the rule, and we've got a lot of problems, the rule that they adopted. I have suggested that there be an advance of the date of attendance. Advance of the intended action to at least give people an opportunity to look at the proposed rule and tell the agency, hey, wait a minute, this is way out in left field. Now, I believe that the agency, if the agency had really gone off, and, you know, really gone off, and 90 times out of 10, they're going to say, gosh, you're right, and will withdraw and change their rule.
Would you summarize briefly? My intent is to adopt the amendments, have the bill engrossed, and then hold another hearing.
Oh, good. Fine. I'd be delighted,
Senator. Could I
interrupt,
please? Sure. No, you use the word shall advance the date.
It's intended
action.
Go forward. If an agency
You don't mean sooner. You mean later.
But advance seems to bring it sooner.
That's what I want to be sure that we
say
what we mean.
All right. All right. I agree,
Senator. Do that right now.
Yeah.
Well, postpone or...
Shall postpone the date as it's intended.
Extend the whatever it's fancy.
Okay. I extend the date of its intended action.
Well, I don't like extend it. I think delay
postpone.
Or
postpone.
Postpone. Either one of those words lets you know this later, not sooner.
All right. Postpone the date of its intended action.
That's a real flag.
All right. The next one that I put in here is the creation of a mailing list. Because it's a reality that nobody knows. Not everybody reads the administrative, the Secretary of State's bulletin. We want people to know what the agencies are doing. All right, but let's at least put the burden upon them to write to the agency and say, place me on your mailing list. So when you're going to do something with the rules that affect my industry, my profession or something, I get it in the mail from you. Question about that is, how about the continuing mailing list in which things die out? So if you'll notice...
Let's not go into the details.
All right, okay.
Right.
All right, fine. All right, that one... Okay, there's an amendment to clarify the effective date of a temporary rule. We believe this is what it is, but it's nice to set it out in a statute. The delaying, Mr. Kalinowski's, we've just dealt with. Public welfare and its enabling act on its contested case or fair hearings says they can follow the Administrative Procedure Act. The Administrative Procedure Act exempts them from contested case. It's a clear dichotomy. It's a clear contradiction between two sections of the statute, which we just want to clear out. Then there's an amendment dealing with the Secretary of State's bulletin, which Mr. Peterson has suggested some changes in. Secretary of State approves it. I have letters, which I want to leave with the committee to establish it.
Could I interrupt, please?
Sure.
So far, I apologize for the first on the mocked-up bill. Now I'm at the end.
Now he's at the front of the whole packet. Now we've moved back around to the front.
Proposed amendments.
Yeah.
Amendments.
I see. Now, what page are we on of the proposed amendments?
Well, we're on page 2, Senator.
Okay. Is this additional material then to the bill?
Yes.
It's
all
new now.
Pages.
Okay. I just want to be sure I was following him.
Okay, we're on page 2 of the proposed amendments. I'm giving a summary now about the Secretary of State's bulletin to clean up and frankly authorize that which he has been doing. All right, on page 7 of the proposed amendment.
What's everything in between?
A lot of it is existing statute, Senator, because I'm just adding sections to very long sections. The non-underlined material is what is
okay,
there.
Okay, thank you.
That's on page 7 of the bottom of page 7, there's an amendment to take judicial review of declaratory rulings of an agency from the Circuit Court to the Court of Appeals. Mr. Hugh Smith, who was on the Bar Committee, and I have discussed this in the past, why it was there, and his admission was, frankly, the proposal was just overlooked. Okay, let's keep going.
See, that's on page 7?
That's really on page 8, Senator, if you'll notice the underlying
delete
Circuit Court.
Okay, I just took your word. You said 7.
All right. On page 8.
Chair, can I interrupt a second? It seems to me like these amendments are so voluminous that the best way to do is get the bill engrossed with these amendments in there and then to consider the bill after that.
Mr. Lowry,
give us a 2-minute summary
of the rest of it.
All right, I'll give you a 2-minute summary of the rest of it.
Want to have it engrossed.
All
All right, 2-minute summary of the rest of it is the Court of Appeals mandate issuance, keying in to the review procedure of professional corporations, the administrative review procedure rather than a circuit court to Court of Appeals, Police Standards and Training Board revocation of certification, the same review procedure into the Court of Appeals. Insurance commissioner has to determine the validity of equality of public employer benefits.
What page is that on?
Okay, that's under section 12, page 12, section 13, in which we add from the underlying material. That deals with the insurance commissioner. Page 12, section 14, beginning. Delete something I had referenced to earlier, which is the parallel review procedure from writ of review plus administrative review. State in page 15, section 15, brings the state engineer's procedure in conformity with the Administrative Procedure Act. These are matters of, page 16, section 16 is a parallel to this business of welfare, where there's a direct conflict in the statute. Page 16, beginning on section 17 and running along, deals with a certification of foster homes, bringing it within the Administrative Procedure Act. Page 19, the licensing function of the Racing Commission.
Aren't they now under that?
They are now under the Act, Senator, but when the Act was in the 71 session, going through the entire seven volumes and looking at every one of the agencies and bringing them within the scope, within their own enabling act, these were overlooked. We did it to about, some 25 chapters in House Bill 1213 originally, but this was just overlooked by the people who did it.
Well, now, this comes under the Human Resources Department or Division, and what they blanketed in?
Yes, they're all blanketed in, Senator.
This is housekeeping, then.
This is really is housekeeping, because I'm faced with a conflict in which somebody says, well, now look, the Enabling Act says this, and the APA says that. Which way do we go? And I'm just trying to clean up that little problem. And these are the result of 2 years of people telling me that conflict.
I get it now.
Okay, on page 25, pharmacies procedure in licensing pharmacies. That was an overlooked area. The agency says, yes, we want to be in there. Now, let me add one more thing if you're going to go and gross and enroll. We have made two changes on these proposed amendments. In letters from the agencies, I have a little bit more, not changing very much, just about three or four more, which I would like to add to there to pick up certain problems. When I sent these proposed amendments out to the agencies, they said, yes, we agree.
Right, go over them quickly.
All right. The Court of Appeals wanted, and as well as being able upon request to send its mandate to the circuit court if the agency or the prevailing party wanted it to statutorily state that the Court of Appeals shall direct its mandate to the agency. It does that. The statute doesn't say so. All right, in section 9, on page 18 and section 19, page 18 of the proposed amendment, in the underlying material, upon deciding to revoke, suspend, or not to renew a temporary or annual, delete a temporary, because no necessity for a hearing if they're going to give a temporary. It's only if someone has come to rely upon an annual certificate, it's our position that they should have an opportunity for a hearing.
The or should go out too,
yes.
And it should be and.
Yeah, a temporary or deleted and insert and. On page 22, Racing Commission, the Racing Commission points out, on page 22, the middle underlined material. Racing Commission points out that this proposed amendment, and I apologize for it, would make them have a hearing before they refuse to license, not to renew, but to license a jockey or anything else, and that would be too much. I agree and would delete applicant. No, after applicant, do insert applicant for a race meet license. Now, a race meet license, if they're not going to give that, they feel that they should be required to give a hearing, because that's a big matter. But if you're not going to let a jockey, if you take him away, he gets a hearing. But if you're not going to let him become a jockey, that's not so much. Okay, page 23, again, Racing Commission. Third line down, they'd like 20 days rather than 10, and that is unreasonable. Well, that's all I have.
Keith, are you leaving?
No.
Oh, I want to ask a question if you're going to leave this bill.
No, I'm
going to
be back. Okay. All I'm doing is moving the amendments.
Yes.
Just so we can consider them.
But I want your advice on this. I want to have somebody refresh my memory about the advisability of moving this from the circuit court to the Court of Appeals. It really kind of bothers me. We talked about it a lot, and I've forgotten all the good arguments. And I thought maybe you'd be one of the people who would understand that experience.
Well, Senator Hoyt, I have to apologize.
You may leave then.
All I want to do is get these things amended in the bill, and then we can consider it.
No.
I don't plan on it.
Senator Keith Burns moves the amendment to Senate Bill 171, and that the bill be engrossed, and then it's my intention to appoint a subcommittee and have another hearing.
If the matter I brought up, whatever the decision of the rest of you is on that, ought to be in the amendment. And if you agree with the amendment as written, that's one thing. I just would kind of like to be sure that we're not compounding a difficulty here.
When I see a pound of amendments to
this one issue is the only thing I see in here that bothers me. And I'm probably wrong.
Well, I think the subcommittee will have to consider it at length, but
it is too complicated.
I don't see any reason for us to hammer it.
Not now, no. Dick, there's all kinds of in here that I think I'm going to disagree with. Here we have a simple little
this guy can
bill,
do it
and
wrong,
they come up
my mind.
With all kinds of hamstringing.
Right. Are you ready to vote on the motion?
Senator Brown?
No, we're not discussing it at this time.
I found that out just a minute ago.
Clerk Caldwell on the motion.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Smith?
I came in late. I'm sure the former representative has a comment that might be helpful.
That wasn't
former.
I think he's talking to the mayor. No, we're doing his engrossment.
Steve Burns?
Aye.
Ivers?
Aye.
Hoy?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Hi, and I appoint a subcommittee of Smith, Ivers, and Burns to keep Burns chairman to hold a hearing and report back to the committee.
I didn't know you were going to do that. I wouldn't make a motion.
Well, we can just report back to table.
Oh, and Mr. Lau, I specifically want you to talk to the Secretary of the Senate, because I think there's a serious problem with the title.
With the title.
Mr. Lau has been advised us that, and this seems to be Mr. Kalinowski's position, I gather. Jack? Oh, Jack.
Yes.
That we can then table 184.
I wouldn't object, Madam Chairman.
Does somebody want to move to table 184?
Well, is this the material in 184 is incorporated? There's no question about that. Well, it looked like 184 was a much better bill. Got a lot of good people on there.
Well,
I don't.
Mr. Maui I'm sure Jack obtained these sponsors, and Jack is evidently willing to go with Mr. Maui.
It was just a question of which bill we were going to work on. Wasn't that really what it amounted to?
Well, Mr. Maui has
selecting the subject.
I put it in, I can put it into 184 if you'd
rather.
Yeah,
I think we just a question of which bill we were going to work on. I move the table on the other one.
Which one?
Well.
The adopted amendment 171.
Yes, the table 184.
Right, the motion is the table 184. Clerk call roll.
Ivers?
Aye, yes.
Oy?
Aye.
Smith?
No.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails.
I move reconsider, being on the losing side.
Right. And this last motion, Senator White, being on the prevailing side, moves to reconsider Senate Bill 184. Mr. Lowy has advised us that we can table 184 because 171 takes care of it. It was Mr. Kalinowski's bill that he carried, and he agrees that it needs to be moved.
All those amendments in 171, I think, take care of every bill in the Senate.
You forget both the key to life legislation.
Will you move the table? Did you hear me?
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Clerk call roll.
Madam Chairman, I didn't realize that we had a motion on the vote on the reconsideration motion as yet.
Oh, right. We have to have one.
That was my... Oh, we haven't had that yet. I'm sorry.
Clerk call roll. Dave Burns.
Aye.
Ivers.
No.
Boy.
Aye.
Smith.
No.
Madam Chairman.
Okay. Aye. The motion fails. Then the next bill on the schedule is...
I'm going to leave.
Mr. DeWinner.
It's 696, Madam Chairman, which is the bill which would set up certain procedures that would apply to the Children's Service Division with regard to foster parents.
Oh, the guy that wants to ask a question. See him sitting right back there? He's a former representative right there. See him?
I didn't make that statement.
With a blue tie on and those kind of things. He looked like an old man, huh?
696.
Oh, yeah.
696 is a bill which provides that for licensing of foster parents, that a foster parent who has a child removed from their home or who is refused certification or doesn't have children placed with them, that they can request the agency and find out the reasons why this happened. They're supplied the reasons only if they request it. If my understanding, the agency is going to do this. I received assurances from them. Representative Peck seems to still want the bill, so what's your pleasure?
Madam Chairman?
Senator?
One thing that concerns me is that one party testified here about many, many things they're unhappy about, and I asked them one question, that is, did you attempt to adopt a child?
Yeah.
One adopt a child that said yes, and the child immediately removed, and the physician of the day was sitting here in the hearing room. And that when they talked to me afterwards, they've had a child since he's 4 years old, he's now 16 years old, and the parent has displayed no interest in that child whatsoever, and that doctor and his wife would never even suggest they want to adopt that child for fear they'd lose that child. And my understanding, my experience, is that it's a kind of a practical way that they operate over there. somebody adopts a child, and they won't be available as a foster parent anymore. And it just it bothers me a little bit that they approach it this way. They don't have the supply of foster parents. They're worried about the supply of foster parents. It seems like a little bit unreasonable, and they ought to bend that rule.
That is one of the regulations. I never let the foster home without the child.
Well, I know there's problems with that, but it seems like here was a physician
sitting
here, had that child, they're 4 years old, they're 16 years old, and the mother has never visited that child, and they're fearful to even ask for that mother's consent. And it disturbs me a little bit, and I don't know whether this is going to solve anything or looking at it anymore or not. I suppose it won't, but it does seem like there ought to be some bending of a rule in certain situations.
Madam Chairman, I'm reluctant to pass this goodbye too quickly. For instance, I'd like to ask Keith, this doctor, was the problem with this child getting the termination of parental rights by any chance?
Well, basically, that's what you're talking about. It's not the same thing.
But that is a major problem.
Well, no. Let me take that back. It's not the same thing. Terminating parental rights is a very difficult thing on the facts and legally.
Was this child, in fact, eligible for adoption and available for adoption?
No, they don't know what the parent would say. They're scared to even ask the parent to give their consent to adoption for fear that they'd lose the child altogether.
Well, Madam Chairman, several cases of this type and the type that Mrs. Longbottom testified from Elmira come to my attention over the years, and I've been a strong supporter of welfare and the children's work and now the Children's Service Division, and I did talk to the director, and he shared with me a copy of a letter he sent to you.
Yeah.
And I recognize that, in a sense, it's a new ball game because Mr. Miller is a delivery service man, not a red tape man. And if he can handle the red tape, he's going to be terrific. If not, it's going to kill him. But I'd like to have a little more assurance. I see Mr. Thim is in the room, and I wonder, since you have mentioned that there's a policy, Madam Chairman, you did say, as a matter of policy, they will not allow a foster parent to adopt a child. I think that we need to explore this, as long as we have this bill before us.
Joe, are you prepared to comment on that?
That would be extemporaneous, but
yeah,
comment on
up.
It. I actually came to listen to the Initial Procedures Act discussion on here. There were.
But you're familiar with this area.
Yeah,
you?
I am, because I know
the
long. I'm Joe Thim, Assistant Administrator of the Children's Services Division and responsible for program services in the division.
Could I start with one question? Are you familiar with the letter that Mr. Miller sent to the chairman?
No, I'm not. Specifically.
Mentioning a new policy about. Trying to cooperate with foster parents and treat them in a little more humane manner.
The letter I'm not familiar with,
but you know,
the policy
is new then.
Yes.
How new is it?
Within the last month, within the last 3 weeks, we have developed a procedure by which we will provide for foster parents what amounts to a grievance procedure in relation to agency actions, removing children, contemplating removing children from the foster homes. This has not been the case in years past. I have the policy statement, the procedures that will go out to our 1,800 staff members within the next week. I have it on my desk at this time.
What do you think about the longevity of that new rule is going
to
be?
I don't know. I not only think that there is a great deal of longevity to it, but I think it's a long overdue procedure. And I'm generally familiar with this bill. I would hope that the committee would consider developing this as an administrative procedure within the Children's Services Division rather than building it into statute, the grievance route that is being provided in this particular bill. I think that, you know, the fact is that foster parents have really been treated as, you know, as less than part of a service family within the child welfare field. And we've done a complete about face in this business as so-called professional social workers in the last 2 years. We've come to recognize that this whole business of foster parents and people who call themselves professional social workers, like myself, are really partners in a business of trying to maintain youngsters in foster homes where it's necessary and return them to their own homes where this is necessary, which actually is desirable.
Well, with my understanding, there was a problem in the agency with someone who had function with foster homes. Now, I don't even know who it was, I don't recall their name, but has this problem been solved?
I'm not sure, you know, specifically what you're referring to. I think that we have tried to develop a clearer lines of communication and authority within the foster care program, and in relation to not only foster care but other, our other programs, we're trying to move decision-making responsibility down to the regional level, down to the county level, where I think it belongs, so that people like myself can serve in advisory and consultative capacities and support capacities to the people who are out there on the line doing the work. The issue that Senator Burns raises about the position, let me say that it is certainly not a policy of the Children's Services Division to deny the opportunity for adoption to someone who has a child in foster care. But when a party applies for a foster child, we try to make it clear in a statement which they signed that this is not a prelude to adoption per se. That if in the course of events they become very involved and they see themselves as being in a position to adopt a child, then they can certainly be part of, they can submit their application and they can be considered by the agency. The focus is on the kids, the child, and not necessarily on that particular foster parent. We run into a lot of difficulty in this area. I wouldn't deny it.
Senator Burns.
Well, I realize it's a very sensitive area, and you've got a problem of reversing a conflict of interest where you've got the parent on one side. What you really hope is that you can work this out so that the parent and child can get back together again.
Right.
And that's probably your primary responsibility. I realize that, but I've seen it as a personal experience where people come to me, and in this example, I use the doctor where I think the attitude is probably been over-impressed by the agency to the point when I cite this doctor, and I think that's a symptom of the attitude of the agency, that the doctor is even fearful of even contacting or doing anything for fear they're going to lose this child they've had for 12 or 14 years, and they'll probably inherit everything the doctor's got because they don't have any children of their own, you know? I mean, they're going to treat the child that way anyway. But I think it's been overemphasized by the agency, and I'm just citing symptoms. That's all I'm doing. If the agency can work it out, I got no problem with it whatsoever.
I think you're very accurate in your observations, and I think it's been a problem in the agency probably going back many years before I ever got there. And attitudinally, I want to work it out because I don't think people like that should just be cut off because they have an interest in adoption. They should have an opportunity to express that interest and to be considered as adopted parents for this youngster if he is free or she is free to be adopted. And I think they'll, and perhaps because they have provided care for one or two or 5 years, they should have a kind of a priori consideration given to them.
Secondary to the natural parent.
Right. But you recognize too as an attorney that this business of freeing up these kids is a tough one. And the new code that we're dealing with downstairs, we're hassling with this issue right now.
Well, Madam Chairman, if Mr. Thiem knows, I were friends and I have the highest confidence in him and Mr. Miller, but I must say that this is certainly a shotgun conversion. To happen overnight, something that you said you've recognized for a long time, and you just lost a lawsuit in Polk County in the last several months, where a child was in a foster home they wanted to adopt. They took them out, they took the child, I say they, or I guess it was Children's Services or Welfare, moved them over to Bering County. The child was never adopted, and I think now, by court order, they finally got the child back. Now, I'm not criticizing you, but I must say that these deathbed conversions leave me cold. And I would like to see, Madam Chairman, since I do trust these people, I'd like to see them send a letter to the committee advising us in more detail than what they put in your letter, what you plan to do, and if I thought you could do it in time under these new administrative procedures, maybe you wouldn't have time, but that you could submit the proposed rules to come before this committee before we dispose of this bill. This is too important to depend. You may not be there forever, and Don may be there, and you know damn well that nothing happened on this for a long, long time. Now, I don't know who to give the credit to, but I know that somebody has to take the blame.
No, I'd be very glad, Madam Chairman, to send a copy of our new procedures over to the committee, and these would then subsequently be built into rule of the agency that would allow an appropriate grieving procedure for foster parents.
Is the thrust of your idea then to postpone consideration?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Just going to keep you honest.
Keep an eye out.
What's the next bill, Ben?
Senate Bill 400, and this bill would extend the occupation privilege to criminal cases as well as civil cases.
Hank, did you want to testify now?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I didn't really come to testify, but I think I can very briefly tell you what we were trying to accomplish. For the record, I'm Hank Crawford with the Oregon Medical Association. I'm also aware of the association that this doesn't accomplish it, although we didn't know that when we did it. What we are trying to accomplish is that, unlike psychologists and clergymen, at the present time, and let's dwell on psychiatry because that's where the biggest problem is. If Hank Crawford is a patient of a psychiatrist and may have been for 3 or 4 months, and suddenly he commits a criminal act, presently those records can be subpoenaed from the physician for what's been being treated with that person, in this case Hank Crawford. It happened here in Salem last year. That's what really has brought it to our attention. The case in Salem involved a boy who was accused of arson. He had been a patient of a psychiatrist. I had intended to have that psychiatrist here for you the day of your public hearing, and he was out of town. And the records were not really involved in the arson case. What the records were involved in is the last 3 or 4 months of treatment. And the problem that the physician sees is if we make the records public to this extent, they're no longer going to get people coming in trying to take care of their illness for fear that anything they say could be held against them sometime in a court of law. And that's our problem. As this one is written, we now recognize that if I went out and got in a gunfight with Senator Smith and ended up coming into the doctor with a gunshot wound because I lost, that the doctor wouldn't have to report it or anything else, and we don't want that. That's not our intention, but we do want this protection of confidentiality for the patient, as I described it.
Is your intention to submit amendments, or are you saying you don't want to?
I would like to submit amendments to it, but I sure need some help someplace along the line. I'm not an attorney, as you know, and it's I know things are hectic for all of us around here, but I know I've a number of attorneys who are legislators that would be willing probably to sit down and work this over for a few minutes to see if we can come up with it. My main intention being here this evening regarding the bill was to ask you not to table it until we might work out an amendment to propose to you.
All right, would you try to get that to us as soon as you can?
You bet.
After you come up with something, we might discuss it with Mr. Litter and then bring it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bring it to us. 408, is that the next one? This is your water main. folder from the city attorney in Portland.
Yeah, this is the one that they called up and suggested they put a comment someplace, and the clerk said they had to do it and write it. I never read it again last night. I remember. Don Barney, is he still here? He's around, I guess. I haven't seen this one, Madam Chairman.
Here we go.
Yeah, I got it here. I guess there's been, oh, yeah, okay.
This was the outcome.
Yeah, this is the one where they did it. They re-engrossed the thing or something, or in the drafting, they printed it up a little bit different. So on page 2, line 16, and then we picked that up, we were discussing the bill. They suggest we delete submersible. Line 16, page 2, and insert,
I've already got a comment with a pencil mark.
Yeah, I got that. I don't even have that. I lost that memorandum. Submersible lands go in instead of, is that right, John?
Just a comment after submersible.
Oh, there's another.
George, John, are you ready to?
Yeah.
The gist of it is that evidently the old law on line 16 read over any tide and overflow of comma swamp or school land. Now, previously the legislature inserted this submersible land, which defines or includes within it these tide and overflow lands. It's simply that that older language, which is still in the law, has not been replaced by submersible. However, when they drafted this particular bill, the person who was drafting it put in submersible into the bill in place of this tide and overflow, and evidently the people who printed up the bill did not catch it. So the statute now reads over any tide and overflow, comma, swamp or school land.
Yeah, that's the problem.
And they put in submersible, which is proper, and I think legislative council has authority to do this now.
The problem is, you got to have a comma, that's it, because otherwise it looks like submersible swamp. Submersible swamp or school. That's all it takes. Mm-hmm. There's a comma after put submersible on line 16. The committee members forgotten the need for this, I'd be happy to point it out. What it is, it's where they already have water mains, sewer mains, already built into the land, and then they, by extending the, by fill, extending it out, then they have to move these out further. And then the other situation is where they have storm sewer outflows, but not storm sewers, but storm
mains.
No, the storm sewers outflows.
Storm weather.
But it's not sewers, sanitary sewers.
No,
it's the storm sewers.
Storm
sewers.
That's right.
And so then they have to extend those out, and this causes when they cover those up and like that, they'll be compensated for having to put those back out there. That's really what the bill is about.
Now, the last sentence of the letter seems to explain the way she feels it should be amended differently from what you have.
No, it just takes a comma after the words of worship.
That's all you want.
Yeah.
Right? Is that what you move?
Yes.
All those in favor of putting a comma after the words of worship on line 16 of page 2 of Central 408, answer by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion
You said that they're going to pay for this. It doesn't say that here, does it?
No, it, yeah, I think it does. Let me look at it.
On lines 8 and 9, page 2.
Any person adding or removing material, then they'll be
liable
to the municipal corporation for all expenses incurred.
I thought maybe that was new language that you were talking about. Moving on.
Okay,
Madam Chairman, could I ask a question, maybe of Keith? What about these fill lands, you know, that we gave them authority in this, with like the court to fill and everything?
I think it'd be included. They'd have to pay the municipality for where they cover up these mains, make them extend them and so forth. I think they'd have to, the beneficiary of those fills would have to pay them.
Well, who would decide where it would go?
Where the...
The extension.
Well, I don't know. I suppose a municipality could not choose an unreasonable way of reaching it. They got to dispute that. What are we going to court to do? I don't think we can do it in this bill. But I don't see any reason for them wanting to do it unless I could see conflicts for the people are going to benefit from the land. I think it'd be consulted where they want water mains and sewer mains. Now, if you're talking about outflows for the storm sewers, then I think you're talking about something else.
Further discussion? Call the roll and motion to pass Senate Bill 408 as amended to the floor of the discussion.
We had Don Seymour here from the Attorney General's office. I remember Senator Hoyt asked him what his priorities were and the three things he was asking for, and as I recall, he answered Senator Hoyt that subsection 3 of line 22 was his top priority.
On my page, I've crossed off number one altogether. I did that myself, or whether he suggested, I don't remember.
Yeah, that's true. I have that note that he said he didn't care about. John, do you have anything further?
The only thing I have to add with regard to the subsection 3, under the existing law, the Revenue Department can disclose tax reports and forms to several different persons. First of all, to the IRS or to the governor or the proper officer of any state or the District of Columbia. This is with regard to enforcing tax laws. The other situation is that they can disclose these things to various Oregon state agencies. Now, under existing law, there is a penalty provided in the instance where employees of the state of Oregon disclose this information. However, there is no penalty, to my knowledge, provided if, say, persons out of state, that is the employees of the Internal Revenue Service or a governor or a proper official of some other state, were to disclose this information. And I believe the intent of this subsection 3 is to apply this penalty to them if they disclose the information. I suppose there's a practical problem in bringing these people within the jurisdiction of the state to impose a penalty. I think that the same thing could be done by simply amending existing statute that prescribes the penalty with regard to employees of the state of Oregon.
Data processors in order to process the records and to give assurances there would be no further attempt to weaken the confidentiality. Anybody want to make a motion on this?
Senator, sort of thought that Section 3 went with Section 2, and Section 2 would sort of feel like we need both for the people and for the department.
Anybody have any questions?
It seems to me that the proposal to give both the state and maybe a parent who is paying support or claiming a deduction should have some way of getting the facts so that they can make an honest return.
Madam Chair, Senator White, isn't this the bill that the Reverend mentioned to us that was up in the judiciary when we were discussing a bill that
they did refer to a bill, Senator, but I don't recall that this was this subject.
No, I don't think it was. Yeah,
well, just for grabs, I'll move that we strike Section 2, Sub 1.
Senator White has moved that we strike Section 2, Sub 1. Renumber the following sections accordingly. Discussion? Clerk Caldwell. Jay Burns.
Aye.
Ivory.
This is just on the deletion.
Right.
Aye.
Boy.
Aye.
Smith.
Aye.
Madam Chairman. Aye.
Now, on the sub 3, Mr. DeWitter, what does that say? Now, I think I know what it says. I want to be sure I know what you think.
What I think it's directed at is this. In instances where information which the department has is disclosed to the governor or an official of another state to permit them to enforce their tax laws, in that situation, this would extend a penalty to anyone in that other state who disclosed information. Again, it's a matter of their obtaining jurisdiction over those people, though, before they could ever enforce it.
Is it related to sub 2?
I don't think that it is. It's
an entirely different subject.
Well, that's... Who's the gentleman from the tax department?
Sir,
would you come back up here, please?
There's no reference there to a person other than a state agency or someone associated with the state.
Senator White, you have a question for
him. I'd like to have your views on sub 3. Is it a particularly critical thing to your operation?
I think it's pretty much of what's in the 314.835, isn't it?
Why do we have it?
And I assume that, I'm not an attorney, but I assume that if under subsection 2, in the hearing that is pursuant to a discussion of who's entitled to a dependency credit, if you give one of the parties information from the tax return, you give them information that has been derived from the tax return without allowing them to see the tax return, then this then subsection 3 is included so that they cannot divulge this information.
Let's go this way. So you get your notes back and you're careful. Well, I'm sorry that I didn't ask the question right. I don't quite get the answer. Do you understand?
Well, I mean, you're missing the point too, but sub 2 is talking about a parent for so they can allocate the support, the credit based upon support of a child, perhaps where there's a divorce or something. And 3, we're talking about some state officer or agency or commission, board, et cetera. Now, to explain the tie-in.
Well, Senator, under the present system, a dependent that's claimed on the federal return, supposing you have divorced parents and one of the parents has custody, the other parent provides a certain amount of support.
Under the statute, if they
provide so much money, they are entitled to dependency credit unless the other spouse can prove by evidence that they provided majority support. So the department's in the position of having the information from one return, and it appears that the defendant is lawfully claimed on this return. Then the other parent files the return and also claims the dependency. And so the department then would have to disallow one of the dependency credits. Now, if they contest this and they bring their information showing the support that they provided for the child, the department, because of the secrecy clause, cannot show them what the other parent claims.
Then, Madam Chair, why couldn't we tie in 3 to 2, say information made known pursuant to sub 2?
I don't know, Senator. I mean, I'm not a
man from revenue. Did he say that the 2 and 3 was stand separately?
And I can see that.
He said that.
Went around and kind of come up to that, but it all tied together.
1 he didn't care about, 2 was important, but 3 he considered essential.
Well, 3, which, so in other words, if you have 2, you have to have 3 to keep the, so to keep the confidentiality, maintain further confidentiality. Is that
no,
right?
No, there already is a section in the statute.
Well, then that's what I don't quite understand. Is 3 duplication of something else? It says there that he shall not, under subpoena or judicial order, divulge further information. Is that the only place in the statutes, or does it have to refer specifically to sub 2, which is a new condition?
Sub 2 is a new exception
yes.
to confidentiality. John, have you got the section there on confidentiality?
Yes, I do. I don't think that say a parent in the situation under sub 2, there's any penalty if that parent were to disclose the information under the existing statute. The penalty, let me read the penalty provision here. It says, except as otherwise specifically provided by law, it shall be unlawful for the department, any deputy, agent, auditor, or other officer or employee, or for any person who has acquired information pursuant to subsection 2 of particular section, which I'll go back to and tell you what that is, to divulge or make known in any manner the amount of income or any particular set forth or disclosed in any report or return requ- required under law imposing a tax upon or measured by net income. Now, over in subsection 2, they're referring to these other persons. One instance is the Attorney General, who says the department also may disclose and give access to information described in particular section 2. The Attorney General, his assistants, or his employees in the Department of Justice or other legal representatives of the State of Oregon, to the extent the department deems disclosure access necessary for the performance of the duties of advising or presenting the department representing the department pursuant to particular sections and tax laws of this state, then it also, besides the Attorney General, employees of the State of Oregon other than the Department of Revenue or Department of Justice, to the extent the department deems disclosure or access necessary for such employees to perform their duties under contracts or agreements between the department and any other department, agency, or subdivision of the State of Oregon relating to the administration of tax law. Then they go on and say an additional person to whom you can disclose this information are other persons, partnerships, corporations, or other legal entities and their employees, to the extent the department deems disclosure or access necessary for the performance of such others' duties under contracts or agreements between the department and such legal entities relating to the administration of the tax laws. So there, I don't think that they, under the existing laws, a parent to whom particular tax information were disclosed would be subject to any penalty in the existing law.
Why should there be that type of information, in a sense? I want to know how much my child is making so I could take a deduction on him, or if a divorced person was having a support responsibility, that would be just the bare bones information. This party has reported that much income, or this party has claimed so much of a exemption for that person, and there would be no further information. Why should that be confidential information?
Is your problem that you're trying to ascertain if both of divorced parents are trying to claim the deduction for the child?
Our problem lies in the fact that we don't feel that if one parent comes in with an itemized list of the support that they provided, And our assumption is that the other parent, from what we gather from the tax return, has provided major support, we don't feel under the existing secrecy clause and statute that we can give to the taxpayer that brings in his records a statement showing how much the one that originally claimed the defendant provided for major support. The Internal Revenue Code does have a section that allows them to do
that.
Senator Burns.
To allow them to get any information, or just the information of whether or not they file a tax return?
Well, it's not whether they file the tax return or not, of course, that they claim the defendant.
Pardon me?
It doesn't have to do with the fact that they filed the tax return. It can give them...
The federal government now handles it this way, that if somebody wants to claim the defendant, both of them are claiming them, then the IRS basically works it out.
Yes.
And what you're trying to do is be able to work it out, too.
Right.
And the other side, really, the parties don't have to know the information. They don't have to work it out. You can work it out.
You can allow one deduction and that's
it. If you interchange the information, catch it.
Well,
I've not thought about interchange within all of it remaining in the Department of Revenue, not necessarily going in.
Well, yeah, that's what we're in a position of having to do now. And so the parent that has had the dependency credit disallowed, it comes in with the expenses that they have provided for the
dependency. How many cases are we talking about?
I couldn't tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Even if we're substantial cases, it seems like all they need is two, because when one parent comes in and he gets this statement after his claim has been denied, he's going to be arguing with the department and not with anyone else. And they already have the information.
Seems to me like the important thing is on line 30, and they get an argument that goes to tax court. That looks like to me like that's
well,
the guts
that's
of sub 3.
Way to go to get
well, isn't that the guts of sub 3, really? In other words, one of the parents gets this information and then they get in an argument. And so they go to court and they try to bring the state employee in to testify. This is to take them off the hook, isn't it?
Is that your problem?
Our problem is that when one comes in and says, well, I provided this much, how much did my ex-husband say that he provided? We can't say.
Well, here's the other problem. Give them the information, and then they got to change the circumstances, and then go ahead and use that tax return. Maybe they should know that. I don't know. Then they go in and file for an increase in support, right? And they learn something from that tax return. Okay. So that's the criteria of changing a divorce decree, is whether there's a change of circumstances. They change the alimony, they change the child support, they can change all kinds of things.
They're not getting the whole tax. All they're getting is an itemized statement of for the dependency claim.
Well, that's what you're talking about. I don't know
what you're about. Well, Senator, could I read this one sentence from the Internal Revenue Code which this is modeled after?
Go ahead.
If a taxpayer claims that the paragraph 2B applies with respect to a child for a calendar year and the other parent claims that paragraph 2B1 is not satisfied or claims to have provided more for the support of such child during such calendar year, then the taxpayer, each parent shall be entitled to receive, under regulations to be prescribed by the secretary or his delegate, an itemized statement of the expenditures upon which the other parent's claim of support is based. If it's a friendly relationship between the exes, they could exchange the information. But if they
request
give us
that information, the problem's our preference.
That's been our experience.
I think Senator White asked you if really the heart of your bill was on line 30, and I don't think she was right there.
I don't know. I was familiar with section 2, and I assume that section 3 follows section 2. So I can't answer the question.
Seems to be a problem here. We probably better have one of the attorneys from the department back. That same subcommittee, Iris and Burns, Senate Bill 410 also on the resolve, but Keith Burns.
Madam Chairman, I wonder if the striking of that first section, whether if they're going to do that, whether we ought to give them a chance to go have the full bill.
Haven't we already done that?
It's already been amended, yes.
As I read that, I maybe it's important. In spite of the priorities they gave us.
Next bill is 418.
Oh, this was the one that the Associates of Oregon, Turk County Turks, won. And I think that. No, I think just Mr. Hardy was the only one who testified. Maybe Mr. DeWitter would explain exactly what it does again. So if you know.
I think what it does is simply make clear that if in counties having a population less than 70,000, they relax the business of the court on election days in order to allow, I guess it's the court employees to assist in election day function. That particular day would not be considered a legal holiday. I guess it was, weren't they having a problem in that?
It's a full crew law. You want everybody working on elections on election day. These little counties really don't have any people in the courthouse.
Is there a better word that can be used instead of election?
I must confess that this bill was drafted in considerable haste. They forgot all about it. It was a deadline for admitting bill. I said, you get to the bill by such and such time, I'll enter this appointment. Steve, will you look at that?
I didn't draft it, Senator. I don't
not
believe.
Not take a look, Steve.
I do recall hearing of the bill, though.
Why couldn't we, well, I don't know how far they want the courts to do, but you could up on sub 2 of section 1, on any legal holiday, no court, maybe open time section, on any legal holiday except election day or something. Why not let the courts operate on election day? Why shouldn't they?
Another thing that you might do is down in line 16, simply say on any day other than a legal holiday and on which an election is held, and then simply delete all the new language, which would make clear that that particular day was not a legal holiday.
You repeat that, what line?
On line 16, if you simply insert after day, on any day other than a legal holiday and on which an election is held throughout the state.
Well, there'd never be an election held in a legal holiday.
Election days used to be legal holidays, didn't they?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah, we put it up and accepted them from the legal holiday. On any legal holiday.
Well, I gather it shouldn't be considered.
No, well, that's all right. I
guess what this was a, this isn't all new. It's just that last part there.
Yeah.
I guess what I was trying to do is to describe the intent of this law originally, right?
Well, I like Senator Ivers' wording better. That relaxing kind of bonds me. You want to repeat your suggestion?
Well, I think up on any legal holiday except election day. If I don't know whether election day is called a legal holiday or not. See, and that's, I suppose we ought to find that out. I mean, unless John knows or somebody. But if it's classified as a legal holiday, then you put on any legal holiday except an election day, or a day that elections are held. Then the courts could transact it. I don't know why they don't.
Seems to me that
I talked to my principal.
It seemed to me that you put there, but merely minimizing court duties or restricting court duties in smaller counties to allow court clerks to assist in election day duties. But merely minimizing and crossing out a relaxing of, or putting in, but merely restricting court duties in smaller counties to allow. We're talking about court duties in smaller counties.
You really want to limit, don't you?
Well, all right. But merely limiting court duties in smaller counties to allow. Minimizing, limiting, restricting.
We put nothing in this section will prevent court clerks from assisting in election duty.
Steve and John, what's your considered opinion? Senator Burns.
Well, I was just talking coin.
Well, I think, Madam Chairman, I move that we strike the word relaxing and in this place put the word limiting.
Right.
And I think that's the easiest way to do it, and the intent is obvious, and most small counties, they ought to be able to figure it out.
Merely limiting court duties.
Right. Line 23, Senator White, removes that the word
relaxing be struck in Senate Bill 418 and the word limiting be inserted?
Madam Chairman, shouldn't that be a relaxing of should be stricken and stricken?
Right.
Yes, limiting. Yes, thank you.
A relaxing of should be stricken.
Editorial error.
Discussion? Clerk Caldwell. Kay Burns.
Aye.
Ivory.
Aye.
Hoy.
Aye.
Clint. Madam Chairman. Aye.
I blew it out, do pass.
Madam Chairman, I'll vote against it until such time as it is set.
You guys got a deal? He wants to get some of my bill.
I'll vote for it when he returns.
Okay.
Do you have any idea when you can expect to return?
I don't know, but I'm not voting any for it to get back.
Well, then, okay, I won't vote for anything until Senator John Burns, Senator Cook come.
Okay.
Senator Ivers, I'm not putting the odds.
That's the same thing.
How can we tell? We don't know when you do it, when you don't.
I just want everybody here that's been participating in the meeting, that's all.
Well, they all should have been participating.
That's right. No, I don't think when one person walks out of the room a few minutes ago.
Come on, you've been in and out of this ever since this legislature convened.
You want to come back when she needs your vote.
I'm not being critical of Senator Smith. I'm extending to him a courtesy.
Whoosh.
The other reason.
How about to the other three of us?
Well, you can go ahead and vote. I'll do the same thing that he wants.
Okay.
Let's go back to that bill on sewers.
No, I won't do that either.
I got burned on Curtis this morning. I don't want to get burned twice. If I burned anybody else.
I've been here.
It constipated it, Rick?
Well,
I'm taking a 3-minute recess anyhow.
5-minute recess.
Let's see. What's the matter with you?